Welcome, everyone, to the Ali Houston Transforms podcast. I'm a former physicist who fixed my brain using nutrition. I now coach people to empower them to do the same. So if you or anyone you know could benefit from a mental health tune-up, head over to metsci.com, where myself and psychiatrist Dr. Rachel Brown coach people to better mental health. And I'm really delighted to have with me Jan Ellison-Basuki. Welcome on.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I think I first saw you on Twitter, and it can't have been that long ago, in the last year, certainly. And it might have been our mutual friend, Ian Campbell, who had retweeted something you'd done, or I'm not sure. But yeah, I guess it would be great if you could just tell everyone what your story is and why you came to kind of lurk in the same recesses as myself and Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. Ian has been responsible for so many introductions in this world of using nutrition to fix brains. I'll just tell you a little bit about our story. And when I say our story, it's our family story. My son, Matt, who is now 26, and my husband, who is the founder and CEO of Roblox. We were all in this together, along with our three daughters. And it started, really, we were just the regular, normal family. And sometimes I feel like Matt's illness was some kind of retribution for me being so smug and happy about how easy it was to raise four kids. And then when he was 17, he started to have maybe what you'd call a nervous breakdown, insomnia that led to panic attacks, very intense anxiety. And we had no idea what was happening. We found him a psychologist. Nobody ever suggested mental illness or seeing a psychiatrist or anything like that. And we didn't think of that. We were sort of the kind of people, especially my husband, who, you know, doesn't even take aspirin. And then he kind of got better. That was fall of his junior year in high school. He taught himself to meditate. He read a bunch of books. He got all over it and he got better. But then when he went off to college, freshman at UC Berkeley, he had a full-blown manic psychosis. And it wasn't like it came out of nowhere. I mean, we knew he was struggling, but we had no idea that there was any suggestion that it would end up to be the diagnosis that it ended up to be, which was bipolar disorder. So that first manic episode was preceded by about a week during which he didn't sleep really at all. And when you talk about bipolar one, which is the diagnosis he ended up with, and you say people don't sleep, I don't think people really understand the magnitude of not sleeping at all, you know, maybe an hour or two here and there. But really, if a bipolar brain can go into overdrive to the extent that it just doesn't sleep, and there's no desire to sleep, no need to sleep, high energy with maybe a couple of hours a night. So then psychosis set in. The first time I heard the word psychosis associated with my son, I was so shocked, because I think most people don't know what psychosis is. You know, they think of people without a conscience, or but psychosis is very simply losing touch with reality. And he had lost touch with reality. His delusions were very much in the spiritual domain. I remember one nurse, once he was finally hospitalized, told me that he had the good kind of psychosis because he believed that he could help other people with his powers. Anyway, hospitalized at Stanford for 10 days, given a diagnosis of bipolar one with psychotic features, put on a high dose of an antipsychotic, and released. And I think at that time, we had a very optimistic psychiatrist, Stanford-trained psychiatrist, who suggested that perhaps it was just a one-time psychotic episode and not bipolar disorder. Of course, my husband and I were very happy to believe that, even though it turned out to be completely wrong. So he's tapered off his medication fairly rapidly over a three-month period, and basically went back to school in the fall and immediately pretty much became manic again and had to leave and come home again. And that started a two-year cycle of hospitalizations and release and residential treatment programs and addiction and you know, every symptom under the sun. We just could not get him well enough to even put in place a program that might help him long term. And then we were about 2 years in by then, and that Christmas he set out on foot and roamed California for a couple of weeks. We lost touch with him, but he was still posting things on the internet. And then he went completely silent for about 24 hours. And that was really scary. Turns out his phone had died and he didn't have any money and he didn't have a charger. So that's why he went silent. But we were able to eventually locate him and fly down. My husband flew down and got him hospitalized again for the fourth time. And it was then that he got insight. So he recognized at that point, okay, I have an illness. I want to get better. He said to me, I never, ever want to be manic again. What can I do? And I think this is a really important part of the story because we had a willing partner in this. He was fully ready to commit. It wasn't that, you know, overnight he put in place all the lifestyle measures that could get him better. It was by no means, that was not how it went down. He put one measure in place and then another measure in place. He quit smoking, he quit drinking, he quit cannabis, started meditating again. He started exercising. He was compliant on 5 different medications for 3 years. All in all, he was prescribed 29 different psychiatric medications, treated by roughly 40 mental health care practitioners, or I should say at least 40. And he was okay. He was back in college. He was living independently, but he was every day he was struggling to master his own mind. And you know, he had grown up as someone who relied on his brain power to get him through everything. I mean, he was very intellectually curious, academically successful, ambitious person with all kinds of passions, from music to sports to chess. And he couldn't even get through the day without having these lower level symptoms of hypomania, anxiety, irritability, brain fog, cognitive function issues, executive function issues. I mean, he really lost who he had been. And at the time, but he wasn't manic and he wasn't super depressed. And so you might have even said he was euthymic, which in bipolar parlance means not manic and not depressed. But we knew he was not himself. And it went up and down so much that after a while, his psychiatrist declared that he had treatment-resistant bipolar 1. And, you know, I remember him saying that, he has a treatment-resistant case. And I remember thinking, what are we supposed to do with that? Now we're supposed to give up and just say, oh, okay, it's treatment resistant. Therefore, he's going to suffer for the rest of his life. We were not willing to go down that road, and neither was Matt. And so we kept trying things. And we tried a lot of things, experimental treatments, conventional treatments, emerging treatments, neurostimulation, where he had a magnet pulsing on his head for 3 minutes on every hour for 10 hours a day for 5 days. And that actually is a very effective treatment for depression, but it didn't provide the mood stabilization that we were hoping for. I do recommend it for major depressive disorder, but I'm not sure they've got the right targets yet for bipolar disorder. And so we kept trying things. And then after about 5 years, not quite 5 years, I met someone who told us a story about going on a ketogenic diet. This is now a very familiar story. Going on a ketogenic diet to treat obesity, usually caused by antipsychotics, and suddenly psychiatric symptoms start to go away. And in this case, it was someone who had had bipolar disorder, 20-year battle, symptoms all his adult life. He lost 100 pounds, he kicked his addictions, and his bipolar symptoms resolved. And he started to have a life again. He told me this story, and I was like, okay, something we haven't tried. We tried a lot of different diets, paleo, autoimmune paleo, gluten-free, dairy-free, various approaches. Those would certainly provide a little bit of benefit, but by no means the panacea that we were hoping for. So I reached out to Dr. Chris Palmer, who was introduced to us by this person we met who has a podcast, a mental health podcast, actually. And we started talking to Dr. Palmer, whose book, Brain Energy, I hope everyone, all of your listeners have heard about, and if not read, that they should rush out and get it. But there was no book at the time. There were some case studies online, but not much beyond that. And So Dr. Palmer, you know, evaluated Matt's case, thought he was a good candidate for a ketogenic diet. We found a nutritionist or dietitian out of the epilepsy world, Denise Potter, to help us put together a team. And I mean, I have to pause right here and say we had the luxury of having plenty of resources, and I had basically stopped my day job, which had been as a fiction writer, to focus on this for the 5 years. So we were able to put all of our energy into this. We had the money, we had the time, we could put together a team. One of our missions is to make it easier for other people, because I fully understand that most people cannot, you know, quit their day job, hire a dietitian, you know, connect with the premier psychiatrist in this realm and put a team together. And we're excited about the work you're doing, because that's, it's such a deep need right now. People need the support they need. They can't go out and recreate all this on their own. That's never going to scale.
Sadly, that's true.
Yeah. And he started the diet January of 2021, January 4th. And that March, he stayed on the same dose of medication, his main medication, antipsychotic. He didn't go up. In previous, March is usually mania season for people with bipolar disorder. Previous years, he'd had to quadruple his medication just to keep sleeping, just to not go manic. Stayed on 5 milligrams, coasted through March. By April, I would say he was in remission. So within about 4 months, he stopped having any psychiatric symptoms. No mania, no bipolar, no depression, no hypomania, no irritability, no anxiety. And those two, irritability and anxiety, are really hard for people with bipolar disorder. It was just, honestly, it's just started to go away. And now we're about 2 years, 2.5 years in, and he's just thriving. I mean, no symptoms of illness at all. And he's been able to continue tapering his medication. He's on about half the load of medications he was on when he started. Very, very slowly tapering. I think he would like to get off of medication, but that is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is wellness, you know, on a day-to-day basis, to be thriving, to be in good health mentally and physically. And he's achieved that now. So it's been an absolute miracle for our family.
Yeah, miracle is the word that comes to mind a lot of times. I never get tired of hearing, I mean, I'm aware of Matt's story and I've listened to his podcast that he does with Ian Campbell, but to hear it from you is brilliant. And I'm just so glad that, you know, he's one of so many who've found this, that they can get better.
Yeah.
From a disease that is still kind of considered in some kind of sort of spooky Victorian hangover sort of way. Like it marks you for life, and that it's really sad and devastating that that's how the news is delivered to people, typically, really. You know,
yeah, and if you're a mom, for the first time you Google bipolar disorder and it shows up in the category of serious mental illness along with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, I mean, it's about the scariest moment I think a parent could experience and an individual could experience. And no wonder people don't want to accept that diagnosis, because it's like a life sentence. And it does not, I truly believe it does not have to be that way. And there were times when I tried to accept that that was just how it was going to be. It was going to live a life of struggle. I don't think acceptance is really my strong suit. So I just kept going, believing there had to be something. I mean, there had to be a reason. There had to be a mechanism or many mechanisms. And we had to keep searching for that. And with the, you know, emerging hypothesis about mental disorders as metabolic dysfunctions of the brain, I think we're getting there finally. Like, we have a path now for understanding these illnesses.
Yeah, when I did the talk recently at the Public Health Collaboration meeting in Edinburgh, that was alongside Rachel Brown and Ian Campbell and David Unwin and Moira Newis. Mm. It was actually coincidentally the day before Mother's Day. And I wondered at the time, you know, what the difference is in your experience of that day since Matt got better.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, night and day, right? we would have been heading into Mother's Day and any other special day, trying to figure out whether we could have the family together, whether Matt was well enough to be with the family, whether we need to separate our daughters, whether we could celebrate it separately, you know, how he was going to get through the day, how we're all going to get through the day. And yeah, now it's just a celebration like any other celebration. I remember a particular day when I realized, oh, you know, we have our family intact again, was I guess last September. And it was my dad's birthday. We're celebrating Matt's birthday and my dad's birthday at the same time. And my four kids were all sitting around in the living room and they were all giving Matt a hard, the girls were all giving Matt a hard time about having a new girlfriend. And, oh, this one's like three dates. Oh, giving him a hard time. And he was just laughing and they were all laughing. And I just sat there and said, oh, pinch myself right now. Like, never knew if this day was going to come.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And you talked about this emerging hypothesis on metabolic processes in the brain. You know, Rachel's book's great. Chris Palmer's book's great. He's been on the podcast. The stuff that Brett Sher's doing with Metabolic Mind is great, talking about these particular processes. You know, when I kind of got better 7 years ago, Georgia Ead was more or less the only psychiatrist who was vocal about this. I know Chris Palmer had been working in this area for a time, but you know, her stuff has always been great. And 7 years ago, it looked so fringe for her to say something like that. And it's it's amazing to see, you know, more mainstream voices taking this on board and taking it seriously, and you know, the research that's been done around it. And, you know, just before we started recording, you were saying, you know, that you're doing a lot right now with Metabolic Mind and with other things. Can you maybe just run through the sort of arms of this mental health octopus, which is growing up?
Yeah, growing up, strangling us. I might as well just tell the story of how it, you know, how it evolved. When Matt first got sick, as I said, I had been writing fiction and I pretty much abandoned that. I didn't say, okay, I'm not doing that anymore. I just found that I was very much drawn to trying to figure out what was going on with his brain. And that became a full-time job. And just, you know, managing his care, I was like the case manager. And sometimes, honestly, the psychiatrist, when we couldn't find anyone or we had to fire a psychiatrist because they were misprescribing, which my husband really didn't like it when I tried to play doctor. I'm like, I think it needs to be 7.5 dose and we should split it up and, you know, do half in the morning and half at night. He'd be going, where's the doctor? We had a couple of early liquidity events with my husband's company. And so we had some resources to invest in academic research around bipolar disorder. And so we did that. I just started calling up. Literally, I would find someone on the internet who seemed to have something interesting, like Nolan Williams at Stanford with the neurostimulation, reach out, you know, have a call, get to know them, give them a grant to study whatever they were doing in bipolar disorder. And we'd been doing that for about 5 years. When Matt got better, we had just hired Carolyn Walsicata, who is now running our foundation. She came on board and all of a sudden was like, whoa, wait, now we have a direction. We'd kind of been seeding the field with seed grants, really. And then it was like, okay, we need to pursue this hypothesis full on. And so we kept that process of finding people online. I found Ian and Harry very early on, just through Google searches. Learned about Shabani Sethi and her trial at Stanford, which was ongoing by the time I was introduced to her. And it's, you know, Stanford is literally in our backyard. My husband and I both went there and we had already been doing grants there. And I had not heard about the Metabolic Psychiatry Clinic, which is shocking to me now. And I had not heard about her trial of ketogenic diet for bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Actually learned about it at the end of a presentation that Ian had done, a PowerPoint presentation that he had posted online. And at the end, it's like, oh, there's this trial at Stanford. And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't know about that. learned about Georgia Ead, reached out to her, got to know all of these people. We tried to figure out, you know, what should happen next. We started funding clinical trials of ketogenic interventions for serious mental illness, so major depression, schizophrenia, and bipolar illness. And then right, it was not even a year ago, actually, I can't believe that, we decided we need to bring these people together. We kept finding out about more and more people who are doing this work, either basic science, translational, or doing clinical work, entrepreneurs who were interested in doing things. So we had a convening in May, last May, in Santa Barbara, and really just tried to put some community around this field of metabolic psychiatry and metabolic neuroscience. There were a bunch of neuroscientists in the room as well. And then I decided at the very last minute, we should film all of these presentations. So we filmed all these presentations. We started to have a community, and then we had all this material, all the footage, and we didn't know what to do with it. So we said, oh, I just came up with the idea of Metabolic Mind. We should get a website and start a YouTube channel so that we can share this content. And then we decided we should try to recruit Brett Scher. And that's how Metabolic Mind was born. So we really have, Metabolic Mind is really about trying to educate and provide resources for individuals living with mental illness, families, physicians, and try to have a place where, you know, a portal where you can go to find other resources. We also have the Baszucki Brain Research Fund, where we continue to fund research, basic, translational, and clinical in nutritional ketosis for serious mental illness. In addition to the diagnoses that I just mentioned, we are also going to be looking very carefully at anorexia. We have an amazing, 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 amazing pilot study where five people had massive improvement in their anorexic condition, really achieved stabilization with a combination of ketogenic diet and ketamine. And so we're going to be doing more research in that area. Brett just shared a video online with the three physicians, scientists who were involved in that study. And it's really so inspiring. And anorexia is the deadliest of all the mental illnesses. So I think it's like a 15% mortality rate. So I feel like this is an area we absolutely will be focusing on. And I think it's going to save lives soon.
That's brilliant. Yeah, a couple of years ago now, I had doctors Agnes Ayton and Ali Ibrahim on the podcast, who are eating disorder consultant psychiatrists in England. And, you know, they wrote a great paper, The Western Diet, A Blind Spot in Eating Disorder Research. Which,
did you send me that? I have not read that. I would love to read
that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Agnes is brilliant. Ali's brilliant too. Agnes has been a doctor for longer. She's been a consultant for longer. She really understands what people with eating disorders go through. It's understandably an extremely sensitive topic. Yes. And the nature of discussion around it is very sensitive, and rightly so, because the question of whether to restrict certain foods is a taboo, to be honest.
Yes.
And so the idea that you could introduce a restrictive diet and see benefits is somewhat of a taboo, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the group that we are, it's another family. It's, the story is amazing. It's was a young woman who struggled with anorexia for 15 years. Her aunt was a physician. Her mother is her twin sister. And she went back to the literature and said, I think we should try this. But she wanted to get a physician on board and at a major academic institution, and they weren't really able to until much later. So what I would say about that trial, and in the video, the physician, the principal investigator, is very clear that this was a small trial. What we know is that they were able to get five people improvement in a very controlled setting. So they actually brought the patients together. Each one had an advocate with them. They spent the weekend together learning how to adjust their macronutrient profile. And then they were very heavily supported with dietitian and case management support. And then ketamine was added. So it's not the kind of thing where you would ever want to suggest that people just go out and try this on their own. I would never suggest that. It's a very delicate issue. And all of those women were adults, and they were also weight stable. So super important caveats. And we're just in very, very early days. One thing I would say, so like very cautious tale, but also very, very promising. When I think about this, I mean, you could say it's restricting foods, but you could also say that it is just switching up the macronutrient profile. And so moving from high carb to high fat, because it has a reputation as a weight loss diet, it, I think, will tend to be more palatable to people who have eating disorders, anorexia in particular, because I think the notion of eating very high sugary, you know, foods is it's hard for people with anorexia. And I think that's, I don't know a lot about this because I don't have any personal experience. I don't have any family members or friends with this condition, but I have heard about this cookie test, where you have to show that you can eat a cookie before you could get released from a treatment center. I don't know how widespread that is. Maybe nobody does that anymore. But the notion that instead of a cookie, you might eat something like, you know, egg salad or something with olive oil, to start to replace the fats that have not been in the diet. I mean, we know how important fat is for the brain. And so maybe there's a way that we can position it, which is more accurate to say that you're not really restricting food so much as just shifting the macronutrient profile. So more fats, fewer carbs, fewer refined carbohydrates, and significant protein, or sufficient protein.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is how Agnes and Ali and others are starting to think about it. You know, it's a question of bedside manner and how it's communicated to the patient, or branding, I suppose. Yeah. To give it a street name. So it's a very exciting area. I guess the wave of excitement that one feels when you have like a Damascene moment where everything suddenly makes sense, it's not all like that, is it? You know, you're met with resistance and challenges. So has there been any major ones along the way?
Oh, yes. I mean, there have been many challenges of all different sorts. I should explain that it wasn't as if Matt went on the diet and it was just smooth sailing and, you know, never, no problems, no issues. He went on it right off the bat, the first couple of days. And I think this is something we need to really be looking at with bipolar disorder, especially. It is possible, there's some indication that for a bipolar brain, going into ketosis can be particularly challenging because it will increase energy in the brain, potentially trigger insomnia. And for someone with bipolar disorder, insomnia can lead to hypomania, which could lead to mania. And so we're trying to study this carefully in our clinical trials. For Matt, it lasted 2 days. He had to take a little bit of extra medication to make sure he slept for the first probably day three to day five, once he got into ketosis. Dr. Palmer warned us about this. I mean, he literally like put the fear of God into us and said, you know, you have to have next to your bedside some medication that can, you absolutely know is going to put you to sleep. So for people who aren't already on medication, I think this is something we need to be considering. So that was one issue. The second issue is that he immediately got COVID right after he was in ketosis, which drove his ketones down and he started to have symptoms again. And then his ketones went really high at one point, because after he got sick, he wasn't eating much. They went up to like 7.5, and that made him kind of sick sick to a stomach. But once we got through those things, it really just started to be clear that something very serious was happening. But I had pursued so many different interventions, and I had dragged Matt down so many dead ends. I was very, like I was saying, is this really what's happening? Is this what we're seeing? Is this nutritional intervention actually healing his brain? And in the beginning, I wanted to believe it, but I didn't want to believe it because I didn't want to be disappointed again. I didn't want him to be disappointed again. I didn't want to start telling people too soon, but then it just became clear. And it was a fairly controlled experiment because he had already had all the other lifestyle pieces in place, except for diet. And so we know that's what it was. There was absolutely no question. So I would say that just if it's hard in the beginning, people need to just push through and believe that if they stick with it, it can happen. And everyone is on a different schedule and different things are going to work for different people. But I do truly believe that if you give it a good four to six months, you'll know for sure if it's going to work or not. And we haven't heard from a lot of people who said, oh, I didn't see any improvement. It may not be, you know, full recovery for everybody, but we know it's good for the brain. I mean, we have 100 years of evidence in efficacy and safety in the treatment of seizure disorders. So if it can stop seizures in its tracks, nutritional ketosis is doing something very good for the brain. And we have evidence in some directions, you know, glucose hypometabolism, reducing inflammation, oxidative stress, a lot of gut microbiome, a lot of areas where we're pretty sure that's part of why it's working. So, and then, you know, people just don't believe it. And why should they? I could barely believe it, and I saw it with my own eyes. So, and that's okay. We're not out there to change people's minds who don't want their minds changed. We're out there to make sure that if someone like me or other families out there that are looking for answers find this information, and then they can decide for themselves whether they want to try it. 2 years ago or 7 years ago, Allie, when you got better, it was, as you said, Georgia Eve. That was the only source of information. And she was way out in front. Chris Palmer was also way out in front. Shabani Sethi. But that was pretty much it. And so we need to build a huge community so that people can find us, find each other. Physicians can get trained, physicians can find patients can find physicians, and the science can continue to unfold as all this is happening. That's the goal of our philanthropic work now, and what we think we need to spend the rest of our lives doing.
Yeah, amen. I think when, you know, I felt that, you know, and what you were talking about of not believing or not really trusting that it was as good as it felt it might be, was tested when I went into my first winter feeling better, because usually that would mean a return of my seasonal depression.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I just dreaded it because it's an inevitability, and it just didn't appear, you know.
What season did you start the diet in?
I started in March 2016. Yeah, I dabbled a bit with paleo and such in the year or two previous because I'd started to struggle to control my weight. And it coincided with starting a PhD in gravitational wave physics that I was completely unable to perform properly at because of cognitive symptoms. And one of my supervisors he's retired early, but he's now retired, Professor Ken Strain. He was part of the worldwide collaboration to find gravitational waves. That's where he spent his entire physics career. But in his early 40s, he was told that he would probably never work again. He was more or less bedridden. He couldn't walk more than about 50 paces without collapsing. And it was just under that umbrella of chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, which, like so many other ailments, you know, like there's not really one schizophrenia. It's more like schizophrenias. Similarly with bipolar, it's bipolars, and there's a blend and a spectrum, and a lot of it is metabolic, and it really just depends on what your genetics is, how it expresses, right? So he had something like that. And then he happened upon Gary Tobbs' work, Good Calories, Bad Calories, changed his diet, and then 6 months later, he was running 10Ks again. So
that is an amazing story.
It's so good.
I hope Gary is a friend of ours. I hope that he has heard that story.
Yeah, so, you know, I joined in 2013 to do a PhD, but I was quite unwell, which had been ongoing since I was a child. And he was able to spot that there might be something metabolically could be done. He developed this deep side interest in nutrition, to a very deep scientific level. And he didn't tell me what to do, but he said, deficiency is a real thing. Diet-induced mental disorder is a real thing. You know, here's where you can read. Here's maybe some search terms for PubMed or for Google Scholar. Just read. And so I think if you have that kind of training and you don't come up thinking this is worth a try, then you haven't really read it.
That's right.
And so March 2016, I thought, right, I'm going to do this properly. I went keto. I did a very strict elimination diet, which was inspired by Peter Dobromilsky, who's got the Hyperlipid blog, which, you know, appealed to me as a physicist that goes way down into the sort of origins of life and why it means ultimately that saturated fat is really good for the mitochondria. Mm. But I was basically living on egg yolks and ghee for about 6 weeks. And until I felt like I had a real baseline there. And I would have what he called optimal ice cream. It was an optimal diet invented by a Polish guy, called it the optimal diet, where it was basically, you know, double cream, or I think heavy cream, do you call it?
Yeah, heavy cream.
And a little sweetener and some egg yolks and ghee and egg yolks. And I couldn't believe how good I felt. It was a quantum leap. And then I started introducing things to see what foods I might have a problem with. I'd read enough to realize that excessive carbohydrates for someone in my metabolic state, no good. Grains, especially gluten grains, definitely no good. The literature on that is so robust, that especially around mental disorders, that I feel like it's surprising that anyone eats gluten at all ever.
I feel the same way. I feel the same way. We went down a big functional medicine rabbit hole, and every functional medicine practitioner said to me, you know, at some point I realized I would be crazy to ever eat gluten again. Yeah. Yeah, it's shocking. And that's, I guess, one of the side benefits of a ketogenic diet is you're not getting any gluten, you're not getting grains.
Exactly, because, you know, like George has said several times, you know, human psychology is really to want to not change very much, but to add something, add the silver bullet, the goji berry or whatever it may be, instead of removing almost everything out of your diet. I mean, that is a hard sell sometimes.
Yeah.
But when it gives people hope, then they just weigh it up. And there's enough people out there who want to go for it that I've learned evangelizing isn't necessarily the way, but offering an option that seems to go across well.
Yeah. So you didn't eliminate dairy, but you said you did cream, but not butter.
Yeah, not initially. I didn't eliminate dairy completely. Obviously, double cream is quite low in dairy proteins. So even though I'd read quite a lot about how autoimmunity, which I had problems with, and mental disorders can actually, you know, coincide with the presence of casein peptides and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
One of my favorite researchers, who's dead now, I think, but it's a Norwegian called Reichelt, has done so much good stuff on this. And how you just need tiny amounts to get into the bloodstream to potentially wreak havoc. And I've noticed that I really have cut out dairy almost completely. Sometimes if I'm really, really hungry and it's all I've got, then I'll cook with butter or but I'll basically never have cheese or yogurt or anything like that now. It's just it just causes too much damage and fallout.
Do you still do the heavy cream or the double cream, as you call it?
Very rarely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apart from anything else, and this is a strange thing. I don't know how you've found it or Matt's found it, but the foods that are worst for us tend to be the ones that we're drawn to like a moth to a flame somehow.
I've done various elimination diets. So I did do the autoimmune paleo diet, which obviously removes gluten and dairy, but also nightshade vegetables and a whole lot of other foods. And I found that to be very difficult to follow, much more difficult than just a more simple ketogenic diet where I basically just count the carbs. I drink heavy cream in my coffee. That's my breakfast. A few other leaders in this space who do that, so I'm giving myself permission, but I don't know how long that'll last. Everyone needs to, I think this is, people keep asking, well, what's the right ketogenic diet? We don't know because it's individual. And I think you just need to start somewhere. I would tend to recommend starting by reducing carbs very, very significantly so that you don't, and then you can add back rather than a start at 100 and then you don't get the benefit and then it takes longer and then you might get discouraged. We just had the most amazing case study. It was published in the literature, and then Brett did a video where he interviewed the family and the doctor. And it was this a woman who, she was in her 40s. She had been born with Down syndrome, but she'd had a lovely life and was very active in her community and in her family. And then she got dementia in her 40s. And the mom started to learn about diet. She was on a paleo diet. She lost 100 pounds. She was gluten-free and dairy-free. And then they went down to, I think, 50 carbs a day, because she was having these terrible neurological and behavioral issues, just really sad, tragic story. It wasn't until she was in nutritional ketosis on 20 grams a day of carbs, her symptoms started to resolve, her neurological symptoms, her behavioral symptoms. The video is well worth watching. I think on our Metabolic Mind channel, it's called Keto for the Brain, a Dramatic Personal History, something like that. And the loveliest point was when the mom said, once she was in nutritional ketosis for a few months, I think, she said her first in her entire life, three-syllable word. She said, I understand. And her mom just started to cry. So that, I think, is such an important story, because we think, oh, you know, 100 grams a day, maybe I'm not in ketosis, but I'm on a very healthy whole foods, low carb diet, which might be great for lots of people. But I think what we're learning is if you have a serious brain disorder, you might need to be deep in ketosis for at least a while to heal the brain. That's what my son intuitively believes happened with him. He did a really hardcore ketogenic diet, was in ketosis, tested twice a day for probably the first 9 to 12 months. And he thinks that healed his brain and has enabled him to be much more flexible. And when I say that, I mean, he has not eaten a piece of bread or a potato or a French fry in 2.5 years. But he doesn't measure his ketones as religiously. And he can eat out in restaurants, and, you know, he doesn't know there might be a little bit of carbohydrates in that salad dressing. So it may be that it is worthwhile being very, very strict for some period of time. And that's what happened in epilepsy for many patients. They were able to be very strict, heal the brain, get off the diet, never take another medication, and never have another seizure. I personally would never go back to the way I used to eat. Before I read Nina Teicholz's The Big Fat Surprise, which is what turned it around for our family. But I don't necessarily think people need to be deep in ketosis for the rest of their lives. We don't know yet, and it's probably very individualized. But when I describe it to people, I like to think of it as an intervention that might show you some things and tell you some things and get you better enough to decide what you're going to do moving forward.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the idea that it's individualized and that it might be temporary. I think that's true. I mean, you look at the work of Weston Price and lots of other explorers over the last few hundred years. I mean, carb level is not a corollary for mental illness. It's just not. So there's some metabolic damage that a ketogenic diet and all the things that are removed with that seem to be very useful for one reason or another. So, you know, and I think of powerful anecdotes like Amber O'Hearn, who had to go carnivore from a ketogenic diet to see bipolar remission. You know, it's not just about the matching the metabolism, is it? It's about meeting the person, who they are, in a holistic way. Because, you know, no idea what someone's motivations are or what their hopes and dreams are or what they actually like to eat.
Yeah.
That's what makes it sustainable.
Yeah. Well, and you don't know how people are going to respond to various carbohydrate macro mixes. You know, I personally, I was on paleo, I was on autoimmune paleo. I did not experience stable weight loss in those conditions. It wasn't until I was really keeping the carbs to about 20 a day that it's like, oh, I lost 20 pounds and I've been able to maintain it for the first time in my life. Mm-hmm. And my achy joints went away and I have better energy and I can work all day with total focus. Maybe some people can get away with eating legumes and brown rice. I can't. I'm never going back. I don't need to struggle with my weight for the next 40 years like I did for the first 40, starting from age 15 probably. So
well, you do share a lot of DNA with Matt.
I do. Yeah, I do. And so does his dad. And his dad, ketogenic diet, lost 30 pounds, maintains it. So it's very much related to, as you say, how the genetics are interacting with the environment. You know, genetics alone, there's probably not too much wrong with most of our genes. We don't have genetic disorders. We have genetics that have particular demands for the kind of environment in which they're going to thrive. And figuring that out is right now trial and error. Hopefully we'll have better tools to predict epigenetic responses over time, but we don't really have them yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be really exciting. And I'd love to get into that more, but I know that we're a bit short on time. So I guess the last question would be, you know, around the individualization thing. And to put it one way, you know, your fight, if you like, transferred from getting Matt better, who's thankfully been in remission for more than 2 years, to helping as many people as you can, which suddenly is, you know, in a way, it's very different in scope, but in a way larger in scope. So, I mean, how do you protect your own mental health while working so hard?
Oh, Ali, this is a good question. I mean, I do the things every day that are important for my mental health, like eat well and go outside and get exercise every day. Beyond that, what my personal struggle is that I used to be a fiction writer and I have published essays and short stories as well. And I have 1400 pages of notes that I took when Matt was ill. I wasn't writing per se, but I was trying to maintain my own sanity by dumping out the story, get out of my head onto the page. So I'd get up really early in the morning, go to a cafe and just say what happened yesterday or the week before or whatever. And so I have all these notes and I'm starting to assemble them into what I hope will be a memoir of his recovery, which I think could help a lot of people. It's like the book I wish I had at that time, because I had so many questions that I could not find answers to. And I have read every memoir of mental illness that I can get my hands on, and I continue to find more and read more and learn more. And I'm just so amazed by the people who can turn that kind of trauma into art that can help other people. So that is my goal. So as much as I am like full-time all in on Metabolic Mind and Bazooki Brain research and running this and growing it as an organization, I also want to write this book. So that is my struggle. And writing is what has always kept me sane. I hope that over time, as we grow the team, I'll be able to step away a little bit more and try to finish the book. But it's going to take a while.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to reading it whenever that is.
Good, thanks.
And so finally, where would you direct people?
We have a website called metabolicmind.org. The YouTube channel, you can find the YouTube channel through the website, is growing. Brett Scher is doing an amazing job as director of Metabolic Mind. Lots and lots of YouTube videos and resources. You can find us on Twitter at metabolic_mind. And you can find the rest of our philanthropic enterprise information at bazookigroup.com. And then if you want to read my book, you can find that at janellison.com. My novel. I published a novel in 2015. I should maybe put in a plug for that.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone should go to all of those websites, get a tab open for each of them, and then buy the book.
There you go. Thanks. Why not?
Thank you, Jan. It's been really nice talking to you.
Thank you. And thank you for the great work you're doing as well, Ali. Take care.
Thanks for listening or watching, everyone. Please hit subscribe where you're watching or listening so you don't miss out on future episodes. Also, please do leave a review. It just takes 30 seconds and it really helps get these messages out there. And if you or anyone you know could benefit from a mental health tune-up, head over to metpsy.com, metpsy.com, where myself and psychiatrist Dr. Rachel Brown coach people to better mental health.